And I'm Leslie, and I'm an alcoholic. I remember our speaker when I first came in, and he's one of the people. He had what I wanted. He always had a smile on his face. He was always, you know, he would give you a hug. And I just, you know, if you had a bad day, it was always just so good to see him. And, you know, he does service work. I often see him giving rides to newcomers or whatever, you know. And he's really just a great example of how, to me, how the promises and the program can work in somebody's life. So with that, I give you Sam.
Thank you, Leslie, for the kind words. My name is Sam. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm glad to be here. I may or may not take off my hat. I don't know. I nicked my head today while I was shaving my head. But anyway, I'm glad to be here. I'd like to say welcome if you're new. AA works 100% for those who work it. Because of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have lost the desire to drink. And for that, I'm truly grateful. So it's really a pleasure to be here today, and thank you for asking me to come out and share. It's an opportunity to, and it's also an honor to think that someone has something, to share with you guys, you know, which is basically my experience, strength, and hope is what I have. And the depth and weight with which I would be able to transmit that, depends on really, you know, how truthful I am, really. So I hope I'll be able to, transmit something, to you guys. The one thing that, that the most common thing that I would hear, or at least that I hear, means, I've gone to quite a few meetings over the years, and that is, I once suffered tremendously, but now my life has transformed. So if you don't get anything else out of my share tonight, know one thing, and that is I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. It wasn't always like that. From the very beginning, I when I would see people drink, I saw that it would do something for them. In some ways, it would transform them. And I was aware of that at a very early age, that the effect it would have on people. And I remember the first time I drank with my friends, I thought that because of that, when you drink, even if you didn't get drunk, you were supposed to do something stupid. So we were out in this ball field, and this baseball field, and we all shared a bottle of wine or something. And after the bottle was gone, we all took off our clothes down to our underwear and just ran around like we were drunk, like little stupid kids. So, and that's right. I thought, and from that moment on, I always drink for the effect. I liked what the booze did for me in the beginning, but in the end, I didn't like what it was doing to me. Booze did something for me. It really did. It transformed me. I was one of those like I said, I drink for the effect. The first time I drank, I drank because I thought it was going to do something for me. I knew it was going to do something for me, and it did something for me. And I guess I should back up a little bit. I'm kind of getting off course a little bit here. Just to give you a little bit of history of where I came from. I was born and raised in a place called Montgomery, Alabama. And from there, I went through grades 1 through 12. And after high school, I went into the Navy. And, I didn't, drink heavily before I went into the Navy. But when I went into the Navy, that's where I learned how to drink. That's where you're supposed to learn how to drink like a sailor. And, and that's what I did. I was always, wanted to be one of those guys that fit in. And I liked being a part of the crowd. And I also liked the hip slick and coolness that came with it. So in the Navy, I went through boot camp, and I did everything they told me to do. I was an A1 sailor. in boot camp. And when I got out of boot camp and I checked on board the ship, I did everything they told us not to do once I checked on board the ship. I hung out with the wrong crowds. I wanted to do, you know, the Navy part-time while be a civilian full-time. And the Navy simply didn't appreciate that. And because of that, I faced disciplinary problems. You know, I wanted to drink and drug. I just basically wanted to do my own thing. And so after, you know, a few years in the Navy, I think they attempted to send me to treatment once. And, you know, and that didn't work. And so they basically just classified me as being nuts, you know. And I was discharged under medical but honorable conditions. And, you know, just to back up a little bit, you know, in high school, you know, I was basically, you know, just an average kid, man. You know, I played sports. You know, I loved to date. But I did, you know, I drank a little bit in high school. As a matter of fact, I had gone to school one day after drinking, and I don't know for the life of me why the teacher didn't notice this, but I was in class. I mean, I was drunk, literally drunk, and I also smoked a lot of pot. Back in those days, you know, some of you can relate, you know, you can actually smoke on campus. I don't know if you guys could do that in Atlanta, but you could actually smoke on campus back in the day. And as a matter of fact, I've been thinking about the word groovy lately. You know what I'm saying? Why can't we bring the word groovy back? You know what I'm saying? Who says we can't say groovy anymore? But, you know, and back in those days, you can actually smoke in the restrooms. And for the life of me, man, each morning was like a pot party, a pot and alcohol party. And the teachers, they just simply wouldn't mess with us. You know, they just kind of let us did what we wanted to do. And I think I kind of took that mentality of being that hipster and cool guy, being able to get away with things, you know. And I kind of prided myself on that, you know. You know, I you know, just never really quite getting caught. And but anyway, after high school, you know, like I said, I went to the Navy and, you know, and did the Navy thing and checked on board the ship and, you know, and did all the wrong things. And as a result of that, you know, I was discharged and came back to Montgomery with a little money in my pocket. And I think I purchased a car and like a couple of suits. And it's like I went out into a club one night and I woke up like 7 years later. You know, I woke up, it was 7 years later, and I had no car. All my fair weather friends were gone, and I became severely depressed, man. I was really depressed. And, you know, the Navy discharged me under medical but honorable conditions, and I kind of prided myself that, you know, well, I'll take it, you know. But, you know, I had issues. I really did. I had issues. And I had issues a long time. As a kid, I had issues. And I just simply didn't know how to deal with them. I think when I found alcohol, like I mentioned, did something for me. You know, probably a lot of you can relate to that. You know, it did something for me. You know, like it mentions in the doctor's opinion, I was usually restless, irritable, and discontented until I could experience the ease and comfort that came at once by taking a few drinks. And I was all right. And looking back on my drinking history, what I see now is that I was trying to replace something that is irreplaceable and that will always be irreplaceable, and that is the God in me. And as a result of trying to replace that God place in me, I warped my mind into such an obsession for a destructive drink that only an act of providence could remove it from me. In other words, I went nuts in the process. And so, you know, I became severely depressed, and there were times when I would sit in the room in my mother's house. I was living in my mother's house, and I would sit in the room, and I would be grateful. I would actually be happy when it would rain sometimes, because that would give me a legitimate excuse not to go outside. And that went on for a little while, and at some point, I the money kicked in. I started, getting this monthly compensation, and I was able to move out eventually, I moved in with my brother initially, and I stayed there for like a year, and I continued on with this drinking and drugging deal, and eventually I was able to get my own place. And along with my alcohol, I did other things, as you probably can imagine. And I kept that place for probably a year before they kicked me out. You know, they wouldn't renew my lease because I was a very irresponsible tenant. You know, didn't want to pay rent on time. You know, can you take this much? You know, let me pay you next month. People don't do business like that in the leasing business. You know, they want all their money. And so eventually I lost the place. And, you know, and I had to move back in with my folks. And it was quite embarrassing because here I am. I was maybe in my mid-20s. I think, you know, a lot of kids around that age are kind of awkward, maybe between 18 and 20-something. You kind of still feeling for that sense of direction, that sense of purpose. So I moved back in with my folks, and I became a burden on them. You know, I began to steal from them and take from them, and it really wasn't helping them out financially. And, you know, my ambition in life by that time, I got the name Toucan Sam. My ambition in life was to get up in the morning, hustle up enough money to get the two-for-one beers. And here comes Toucan Sam again. You know, he's got enough change this time. And this is, I mean, when I drink, I became, you know, this pathetic person. And that was my ambition in life, man. Alcohol had become my master, as it says. And day in, day out, it just seemed like one vicious cycle. You know, I would drink, you know, I would pass out. I would drink and I would pass out, you know. And, you know, and things got worse and worse, you know, worse and worse. I began to go to jail, you know, the story. I began to get in fights. I was in situations where I probably should have been, some of you can relate to this, probably should have been killed or hurt very seriously. You know, when I think about those situations, you've probably heard me share about this before. You know, I'm able, now that I'm sober, I'm able to look back and see the one set of footprints. And I'm convinced that they were not my own. I'm convinced. That is a very powerful experience. If you ever think about that, you know, those moments where you probably should have been out of here, you know, curtains, Elvis has left the building. You know what I'm saying? Gone. You know, and so I'm grateful, you know, and that gives me a great deal of gratitude, you know, to be able to stand here and to see life from this side, from a different perspective today. You know, today I have a better and a healthier perspective on life today. And so, you know, I went on to the bitter end. I went on to the bitter end, you know, in those last days. It was November 1990. You know, just been complete chaos, you know, fights, jail, should have been dead, should have been shot, you know, and the story goes on and on and on. And so it was December 1990. I'd owed a lot of people money. They were sick and tired of hearing the same old song, you know, I'll pay you tomorrow, you know, just, you know, I was out of excuses. I was simply out of excuses. And so my younger brother just so happened to have come by the house that day, and I asked him to take me out to the VA hospital. So I get out to the VA hospital, and I'm not going out there. My motives are all wrong. You know, I just want a place to hide out. So I get out there, and I tell them that there's something wrong with my lungs, you know, or I think I got pneumonia or whatever. And they, you know, been to VA hospital, they admitted me, and they did the examination. And after the examination, they said, hey, you know, we checked you out, Sam. You know, you're as healthy as a horse, my friend. Get the hell out of here. You know what I'm saying? Be gone, man. And so, you know, and before I left that hospital, you know, I had a moment of clarity. There's a reason why they call it a moment of clarity, because it only lasts a moment. And so I thought to myself, it dawned on me, I don't know where this came from, it wasn't my own thinking. You know, Sam, if you don't tell these people the truth, you are going to die. You're going to die. And I went back to the front desk, and I said, hey, this is who I am. This is where I've been. You know, You know, I think I'm an addict, an alcoholic. I owe a lot of people money. My life is in danger. Please help me. You know, the truth. There's power in the truth. There's power in the truth. And they recognized that. They responded to the truth. And they said, well, you can talk to this guy. Never forget his name. Last name is Green. This was back in 1990. And he asked me, he said, well, Sam, do you have a place that you can literally hide out for a few days? Literally hide out. Because that's just how much I had run amok. And I found a place to hide out for a couple of days. And I think maybe 3 days later, they placed me on the bus, and I left Montgomery under the cover of darkness, literally. And I was placed on a bus. Those last days of madness and mayhem, and I was lovingly placed into captivity, safe from myself. And I landed in Atlanta, I think it was December 4th, 1990, of course, on a Greyhound bus. Got off the bus, was in Atlanta, 45 minutes? Off the bus, in a taxi, at Magic City. Hey! You know, hey! You know, out of all places. You fool! What are you doing here? I thought I'd just tie one last good one on, you know what I'm saying? Just one last good one. And so here I am in Magic City of all places. And I think I was in there maybe half an hour, because any guys know if you go to a strip joint, man, that can be frustrating, actually. You know, you spend all your money and leave even more frustrated before you went there, right? You know what I'm saying? It can be frustrating. Some of you guys can relate. But anyway, so I'm out of there, and I'm in a taxi, and I'm just going to say this once. I won't harp on this particular area of mine, abuse. And so I was in this taxi, and I offered a taxi driver, $20 to take me to any crack neighborhood in Atlanta, Georgia. Any crack neighborhood, USA. And, of course, he obliged. And I, you know, got what I went to get, went back to a hotel, the Atlanta Hotel, downtown on Lucky Street. Anyway, so I get there and I blow everything I have. And not only that, man, I check out of the hotel, get my deposit back because it's my money. And I get that little bit and I spend it. And so now I'm ass out, literally ass out in Atlanta, not even quite 2 hours, maybe 2-3 hours by now. And here I am, man, new to the city. I'm out begging on the streets. That's what I do. That's what I do when I pick up. I have very pathetic behavior, very sick behavior. When I'm under the influence, my behavior becomes both predictable and unpredictable. What I mean by predictable, I do just about anything. What I mean by unpredictable, there's no telling what I wouldn't do. An alcoholic is a man or woman who has lost the ability to control their drinking. So when I drink, I am out of control. I'm convinced alcoholic. And so I check out of the hotel. And so here I am. So what do I do now? So I realize I have this uncle in Atlanta. So what kind of story am I going to tell my uncle? You know, my wallet flew out the window. You know, I was mobbed by a bearded woman and 6 midgets and what? You know what I'm saying? What am I going to tell him? You know, so I came up, apparently whatever I told him was sufficient. He came down, checked me back into the hotel, the very same hotel that I checked into, that I had just checked out of, got my deposit back. And as I'm standing there in the doors, you know, the doors are closing. And he's standing there looking at me. It's kind of like the gates of hell. And I'm still trying to beg him for more money. You know, just $10 more, please. Just $10 more. You know, he just shook his head and just in disgust. You know, how dare you? You know, get me out of my bed, come downtown to check your trifling ass back into a hotel. And that's what I do, man. That's my behavior. An alcoholic, they say, is like a tornado rolling through the lives of others. Me, me, me. Very selfish disease. It takes and it takes, but it never gives. No matter how much you give it, it still wants more. One is too many. So somehow, by the grace of God, I somehow I make it through the night. Somehow I make it. I think I made one more half-assed effort to get some more whatever. But somehow, by the grace of God, I found martyr, and I made it to the VA the following day. That was December 5th, 1990. Stayed in at the VA, went through treatment. Treatment is where I was separated from the booze. I was separated from the booze. They informed me as to what it was that I had. You know, Sam, you are probably an alcoholic. You know, how much you drink? You know, I do the 20 questions and all that. And so they came to the conclusion that, yes, you're probably an alcoholic. You belong here. So I stayed there. It was right around the holidays, so they actually allowed me graciously to stay there for an extra week. So my last week there, I had this debate. Do I go to a halfway house? You know, why do you want me to go to a halfway house? You know what I'm saying? I can get me a hotel room. I can do this on my own. I can do bad by myself. Well, Sam, you've been doing bad by yourself all your damn life. And look where yourself got you. You had to leave town under the cover of darkness, running for your life, man. What are you thinking? But anyway, I came to my senses, and I ended up in a halfway house. I never forget Mark Bird. Some of you guys at Turnaround is my halfway house. And Mark Bird, that was back in 1991, he had a little bit more hair, so did I. And he came, you know, looking like a hippie, and I said, damn, this guy look like a dope dealer, man. He probably going to want me to sell some dope or something. But anyway, Mark turned out to be a cool cat. But anyway, I went through Turnaround and had no intention on staying there as long as I did. It was my, you know, little plans and designs to be there maybe, long enough to save up a little money to get my own little spot, you know what I'm saying? My own little pad, man, you know, so that I can resume my madness as soon as possible. You know, but I was going to do it right this time. You know, so I was going to do it right. You know, last time I did X, Y, Z when I should have done, you know, the other one. But anyway, somehow I guess I should back up. I was at Turnaround probably 45 days. Probably 45 days. I had gotten some money. And I told the director half the truth. You see, there's power in the truth. You know, half measures of elders, nothing. So I gave him half the money. Because by now, and after 45 days, 50 days of sobriety, I needed some Sammy time. You know what I'm saying? So I was just a little Sammy time. So I decided I was going to go downtown Atlanta. This is my intentions. I mean, it was true intentions, my real intentions. I was going to go downtown and get a pair of hush puppies. And maybe catch a movie while I was out and just, you know, catch a little the taste of Atlanta. You know what I'm saying? And would you believe, man, I repeated the exact same pattern I did the day I got here. Magic City, hey! Hey! I was there no more than 30 minutes, maybe 45 minutes. Because that shit can be frustrating, you know what I'm saying? That shit can be frustrating, man. So here I am in a taxi, the exact same pattern, you know, take me to any black, blah, blah neighborhood, USA. Back in a hotel on Lucky Street in Atlanta. And that's where my thinking, that's where disease thinking got me. And so, you know, by that time I'm carrying a white chip in my pocket. And so I get, you know, back to the room with my stuff. You know, I'm fishing around my pockets, you know, looking for my, whatchamacallit. And I pull out my white chip because, you know, that was, you know, I really meant it that time, you know what I'm saying? You know, that was just in case I thought about using, I was going to, you know, I was keeping that in my pocket. But white chip and all went that day. I pulled out the white chip, and I placed it on the dresser, and it broke. right down the middle. But you know what? In all that, it didn't stop me. It didn't stop me. But what it symbolized was that perhaps, Sam, you have broken your promise. And so here I am. I really did it this time. You know, how did you end up back here again, man? You know, so this time, you know, I check out the hotel, the exact same pattern, the exact same madness. You know, but this time I get on the phone, I'm out on the street asking strangers for money. And so after all the chips were down, you know, I'd call relatives, they wouldn't send me any money. I tried to come up with the best excuses, couldn't come up with any. And finally, I surrendered. Well, I didn't, like, surrender. I just didn't know what else to do. You know what I'm saying? I didn't know what else to do. And so I made my way down to Martyr. And earlier that day, since I had taken the bus, I had what's called, I think they call it a transfer. If you take Martyr, you take a little, if you're going to catch a second bus to get to your destination, I think it's called a transfer. So by then, my transfer had expired. And it kind of reminded me of the term, you know, true expiration. When one dies, you know, they expire, you know. And I was close to death. I was, you know, spiritually, you know, just very close. So I made my way down to Martyr and in my pathetic state. So there was a guard at the gate. And looking back on that situation, that man was the gatekeeper of my life that night. He could have very well been the gatekeeper of my life. And I handed him the transfer. It was all wrinkled and, you know, just balled up. And he looked at me and said, "Young man, your transfer has expired." And I don't know what came over him, but he said that, "But you know, I really don't like to see people this way. I really don't." And he opened the gates and let me in. Because otherwise, I had called everybody I knew. I don't know what I would have done, you know, what lengths I would have gone to continue on with my madness. I don't know. But what I do know is, as a result of that man opening the gates and letting me in, I got on the train. I made my way back to Turnaround that night. That night, we were having a community meeting. I remember, you know, Donna and I went through the same, we were there at the same time. And I didn't say anything that night. But the following morning, somehow I guess the guys just kind of picked up on it. And, you know, I guess they can tell, huh? Your ass been using. What? Yeah, you been using, dog. Come on, man. But anyway, he said, "Well," I finally owned up to it. I said, "Okay, yeah, I did." And they convinced me to go back and pick up a white chip, and that was January 24th, 1991, which is my sobriety date today. And, you know, something happened, you know. It occurred to me that because I was seriously trying to get that one more that night, you know what I'm saying? I just, that one last good one, you know, before you call it a night, if there's such a thing as calling it a night. But I wanted to get that one last good one. But it dawned on me the following morning that, Sam, if you didn't get it that night, why go back looking for it, dog? You know what I'm saying? Why go back looking for it? And that was kind of like, I don't know, an epiphany or whatever. And from that day, I started going to meetings regularly. At that time, we were down on Buford Highway behind the Waffle House, right before you go out of 285. And by that time, there was a group called Night Owls, which was a spinoff from the Biscayne Room. And I was kind of like the young person in the bunch, so they kind of gave me the attention. You know, and you know, a lot of this was foreign, man. A lot of this was foreign, you know, coming to AA, and this was just not the most attractive outfit that I'd ever come in contact with, you know what I'm saying? Initially. And, you know, the language that was spoken here, you know, the things that you did, you know, I was not accustomed to that. I had become unaccustomed to that. And I think I was attracted to you guys. I was attracted to the fellowship before I was attracted to the program. You see, there's power in the fellowship, there's power in the program, and there's definitely power in God. And I became involved. I became involved. I started making coffee and things like that. And, you know, people began to get to know me. I began to get to know others. And I began to feel a part of something. I felt that what you guys were giving me was genuine. It was real love. You know what I'm saying? It was the real deal. Although I couldn't explain it at the time, but it was real. And so, you know, I got involved, and at some point, you know, I noticed that I wasn't looking at the clock on the wall as much. You know, I noticed that. I began to notice little things. I noticed that I was beginning to kind of, you know, you turn out to be pretty cool. You know what I'm saying? Pretty cool to hang around. And it was just your mannerisms. Not so much in what you said, which was, you know, you spoke the language of the heart, but you also walk the language of the heart. So not only was I listening to what you were saying, but I was listening to what you were doing. You know, actions speak louder than words. And so, you know, the days turned into weeks. The weeks turned into months. You know, and it was suggested, you know, Sam, you know, I heard things like, you know, don't count the days, make the days count. Now, I once spoke at a prison out in California, and one of the guys, you know, prison talk, hey man, you know, like, I ain't serving time, man. You know, time is serving me. I said, yeah, that's really cool, dude. That's really cool, man. And it makes me wonder, you know, am I serving time in AA, or, you know, or am I, in, you know, am I still, in other words, am I still a prisoner, just in a different uniform, or am I, have I come to know a new freedom and a new happiness, you know? So I don't want just to be just a prison in a different outfit today, you know. I want to be free, and I think that's very possible. It is possible, and and so, you know, I'd gone to Kmart one day. I was still at the halfway house, so I went to Kmart one day. I was like maybe 6 months in the program, and as I was walking back from Kmart, it dawned on me what I had in my bag. And what I had in my bag was like toothpaste, deodorant, and underwear. I had gone there purposely to purchase my own underwear. You know, that had been a minute since I purchased my own underwear, believe it or not. Things like that were not on the top of my list of priorities by then. You know what I'm saying? And as a matter of fact, if you think about it, when you're wearing fresh underwear, you walk with a sense of confidence, don't you? Think about it. Think about it. If you're not convinced in the morning when you put on your underwear, do three squats. Anyway. But I found that to be true, really. So in some ways, sobriety to me is like wearing a fresh pair of underwear. I don't care what you say. You call it a new pair of glasses. I call it a new pair of drawers. Anyway. So it dawned on me that something was happening in Sam's life. Sam was getting to know a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, I was waking up. You know, I became aware that I was waking up with actually, you know, money in my pocket from, you know, from time to time. You know, and things were changing. You know, things were changing. And I think about 6 months, I fell in love. You know, I fell in love sometimes. I fell in love. I was 9 months. I think she was like 7 months. Yeah, she was sober. I was sober. We were going to live happily and soberly ever after. You know what I'm saying? I was in love, and I was all shook up, baby. This AA stuff really worked. You know what I'm saying? There is a God. But anyway, it lasted for about 2 weeks, and then. Man, I was, I mean, I was, I was, I was, I was destroyed, man. You know, I wanted to call her sponsor and beg her sponsor, you know, to tell her not to do this to me. And, you know, what a great guy I am. And just give me one more chance. And anyway, it didn't work. She just moved on. But, you know, I had gone to enough meetings to have heard people share about breaking up, you know, in relationships. See, one of the benefits of going to meetings for this alcoholic is that I'm reminded of the things that I'm subject to forget, and I'm probably going to hear something that I've yet to experience. Experience, strength, and hope. When I lost my father, I had gone to enough meetings to have heard that people lose loved ones. People lose loved ones, and they don't drink. You know, I've seen people, probably a lot of you know people, I'm sure, who have gone through terminal illnesses. They didn't drink. Those are my heroes. You know, if anything speaks louder than words, that's, man, that's the ultimate. So what's my excuse? So anyway, I really get involved. I became, you know, an avid reader of the literature. I became really interested in AA. You know, I began to, and I just kind of got involved. You know, and I realized that AA is the lifestyle. I had to, you know, change my lifestyle. You know, and which means that you don't stop having fun and doing things. It means that that I'm behaving differently today. At least I'm practicing changing my behavior. It doesn't mean that I'm, you know, that I claim perfect adherence to these principles, but it doesn't give me the perfect excuse to not be the best fan that I can be. And so, I get involved, you know, I go through the steps, I get a sponsor, you know, they say get a sponsor, you know, call the sponsor, you know, because, I mean, how often, you know, we sit in meetings and they tell us at the very beginning, it's quite customary, in AA, when we read how it works, the first few lines, they tell you how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to the simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. And there are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. See, once again, there is power in the truth. Did I have the capacity to be honest? In other words, was my ass whipping sufficient? Was it? Was it or was it not? That's the question. Really. So far to this day, my butt whipping has been sufficient, you know. And so I got involved and I went through the steps and, life began to happen, things began to come back, you know, because I was one of those who accepted the fact that I was probably going to die on the street somewhere in a gutter, you know, and who cares what happens after that anyway? You know, my life was over. I had completely given up. Seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Seemingly, you know, the pertinent ideas that I was an alcoholic and I could not manage my own life, that probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism and that God could have relieved himself. Seemingly, I had given up. And I don't think I could have ever done this on my own. You know what I'm saying? I don't think I could have ever figured this out. And so, here I am, you know, things begin to come back. You know, relationships and, you know, family members, apartments and vehicles and credit cards. Let me say it again, credit cards. And so I get these credit cards, right? And I'd heard people share about credit cards and meetings, but that didn't apply to me. You know, because I was one of those who I didn't come to the program with a driver's license. So you get things back. You know, things in most cases they come back if you stay sober long enough. And as a matter of fact, I was surprised. You know, when I got sober, the life expectancy of a $20 bill. You know what I'm saying? I realize that with a $20 bill today, in this day and age, you can take your girlfriend to a movie, matinee that is, and get a medium popcorn for $20 bill. And if she tried to ask for like a soda or something like that, throw that low carb thing on her. You know, baby, you know, it's best to drink, like, get a courtesy cup of water, in other words. And you have spent no more than $20. That's how far a $20 bill can go these days versus what I used to do with it before I got here. So, but anyway, you know, I was one of those, I mismanaged, you know, the credit cards, and as a result of that, you know, I was doing things on my own. I was in the self-will, and you know, I led up on the spiritual program of action and just mismanaged it. And it landed me in bankruptcy court, you know, some years ago. And it was embarrassing. It was humiliating. So I believe there are two kinds of awakenings in AA. There's a spiritual awakening, there's a rude awakening. You know what I'm saying? I was rudely awakened. And so I kind of, you know, recovered from that somewhat a couple, two or three years ago, maybe four or five years ago before I went to California. You know, I went out there and I realized that, you know, I just say, wherever you go, there you are. I took Sam with me. But I had gone to enough meetings to know that, and I've heard people say that wherever you go, there you are. You see, I was picking up information along the way. So I knew about the geographics, you know, that really wasn't the fix. So I knew, I intuitively knew that Sam, if I didn't begin some inside work, that I was probably going to be either excessively miserable or I was going to do both and drink again. So I decided, rather than pursuing the adventure that I had in mind while I was out there at full force, that I probably need to get some time to Sam. And what I found was I found me. You know, I had to lose self to find God. And in finding God, I found me. And it was in me that I found God. You know, may you find him now. And then I realized that I had a responsibility. You know, once I had found my truth, I now have a responsibility to give that truth a voice and to speak it unapologetically, but with compassion and consideration, and with the absence of arrogance. And so what I'm saying here today is that, you know, there are many different speakers. You know, I think what Leslie read in the beginning about, it shows a cross-section of members, you know, who show in his or her own individual way how they have had their own spiritual experience. So what I say, you know, if my truth resonates with you on some levels, then so be it. But then there might be another speaker or someone whose share would resonate, you know, with you as well, or maybe not. But my point is that I guess we all have, you know, something to say, our story, which is our story. You know, my story is my story, your story is your story. And I just try to transmit that as best I can. So, today, in the 10th step, by now sanity will have returned. And when I think about the word recovery, to me, that either imply or suggest one or two things, and that is that I have been lost, something has been lost. And secondly, that there's a condition from which one is recovering from. And in my case, it was a hopeless condition of mind and body. And I believe that those who have recovered have found themselves. You know, those who have recovered have found themselves. So I don't want to be lost again. You know, and I do have a new attitude and outlook upon life today. And I don't want to lose that. I know that I've been given a second chance. I'm very much aware of that. And when I'm reminded of that, and when I can stay in a place of gratitude, you know, it really helps. It really keeps me humble. It really does. So, Leslie, thank you for, you know, having me to come out and give me the opportunity to share a little bit of me with you. Like, thank you guys for listening. Thank you very much.